I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, your listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kullberg is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. Regular listeners to KBOO know of our Build a City of Media Makers Kickstarter campaign, which will end this Friday with the goal of raising $20,000. We still have a ways to go. You can get in on the action by going to our webpage, kboo.fm/Kickstarter. We'll be giving you more information about the campaign throughout the program. On today's program, Old Mole's Bill Resnick and Joe Clement discuss the teacher strike in West Virginia, the first statewide teacher strike in U.S. history. Later, Jan Hawken talks with psychiatrist Elizabeth Berger about the role of international networks in supporting Palestinians living under Israeli occupation. Hawken also leads off our program today. She'll be talking with Alyssa Pariah and Nikki Elizabeth Milano about International Women Day this coming Thursday, March 18th. Alyssa Pariah is an Afro-Puerto Rican trans woman from New York City and an organizer with Don't Shoot Portland, an activist in the movement for Black Lives. Nikki Elizabeth Milano is a socialist feminist community organizer and educator currently based here in Portland. Among other things, they'll be talking about the intent of the women's strike being called for that day.
Good morning. This is Jan Hawken here today with Alyssa Pariah and Nikki Milano to talk about the women's march and strike coming up this Thursday in Portland. And indeed, it's a global event. This is the International Women's Day celebration that's been around for over a century now, and the second year of a call for recognizing the undervalued and underrecognized work of women through a strike. So welcome to KBOO, Nikki Milano and Alyssa Pariah. Well, you're both activists, organizer, and come out of many social justice movement projects and campaigns, and I think bring a lot to the interesting and vital work of feminism these days. So let's start with talking about what's happening this Thursday. Nikki, can you just lay out a little bit of what will be happening this Thursday, and then at the end of our time, we'll give people more details about how they can find out about the march and strike.
Right. So the International Women's Strike is essentially a network of women that emerged out of organizing a strike last year, 2017, for International Working Women's Day. And this year is their second call to action. So there are women in over 50 different countries who are involved in varying different capacities to this. Different countries have different calls for different actions. And so in the U.S. here, the call is currently for a one-hour strike from 4 to 5 p.m. This was decided by the organizers based on the current kind of level of class consciousness and just level of struggle that we're at here in the U.S.
In terms of whether a strike and a work stoppage at a significant level can be pulled off.
Right, because, you know, we're currently still in this era where we're still, as the left, recovering from these attacks from Reagan, you know, these anti-labor attacks that we've seen, these anti-left attacks that we've seen for generations now. And the strike as a tool of the working class is not as generalized in our struggles here as it was before. So that's why the call is for 1 hour currently. But that isn't to underscore the importance of this at all, because, you know, what we're really trying to do here is highlight the fact that all kinds of women's labor, whether it is the labor that happens in the workplace, the labor that happens in home, the labor that happens in all of these different spaces, you know, much of it that is unpaid, whether it's in the workplace and you are being asked to smile more than your male coworkers, you're being asked to endure sexual harassment with a smile on your face, right? That's already extra labor. Then you go home, you have to take care of kids, you have to take care of family, right? So we acknowledge that there are all kinds of different forms of labor that women are engaged in. And we understand coming together and refusing to engage in that labor together and resisting that labor being forced on us. So for Portland, we're specifically organizing a solidarity action. We're going to have a rally during the strike time from 4 to 5 p.m. in which We have lots of different awesome women, amazing organizers who are going to be speaking there. And then we'll be having a march followed up by a speak out, which is an opportunity for people to share their own experiences and rally together.
And you both identify as trans, and that's an important time in history for the trans movement. There's always been a challenging of the concept of woman in feminism and what it means to be woman, what it means to use that term. Alyssa, could you speak a bit to trans politics and the inclusiveness of the idea of a women's march?
Yeah, a bit. I should acknowledge that I know that there are people that do not want trans women to be in feminism, that don't regard trans women to be women at all. And to you, I would just say, I'm sorry, because you are losing this battle. There are more and more women, particularly feminists, people that are involved in social justice work that uplift and affirm trans women and trans people across the board. I did not see anywhere that this is called a cis women's strike, right? It's a women's strike. And I don't think that by me being in the leadership of making the solidarity action happen in Portland, or me asserting my space, does anything to undercut any of the work that's being done and has been done by cis women. And if that's something that is perceived, I just don't know what else to tell you, except that I will continue to struggle, and good luck to you if that's not something that you want.
It's interesting to try to separate issues that we've come to terms with as a movement in the left or feminism, and we can agree enough to move on, and people can grumble about it on the margins. Yeah. But we've come to certain ideas of what it means to be progressive versus issues that are still important to keep in our debates. And this idea of feminism for the 99% mm-hmm. is, I think, an example of trying to extend feminism as a mass movement, a very, very large tent. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the importance of recognizing different feminist traditions mm-hmm. and to debate those traditions.
Yeah, sure.
So maybe we could talk a little bit about how each of you sees feminism mm-hmm. and what are important issues to still debate mm-hmm. among the, you know, that tagline, feminism for the 99%. Nikki, do you want to respond first?
Sure. So in terms of feminism for the 99%, you know, I know that this is obviously borrowing from the language of Occupy Wall Street, right? And I think that it's important to remember that this isn't to say that feminism should be a homogenous entity, right? That feminism has to be this one thing that is applicable to all of the lives of those people, right? Because that's just not possible. There's all sorts of differences, as you were saying earlier, that we need to account for. But it is saying that based on our material interests and recognizing that there is this increasingly small elite holding the vast majority of the wealth in this society, that regardless of these differences, which we absolutely have to confront, which we absolutely are part of our struggles as well, that we do have this shared material interest to fight to make sure that the wealth in this society is equitably distributed, right?
It's not just a matter of putting women as CEOs or on corporate boards.
Absolutely. It's not just a matter of having Hillary Clinton-type figures getting elected in whatever kind of political office. It's actually like we have to think like in terms of working class women, in terms of the women who are working all these different jobs, who are making all these low wages, like, how do we uplift them, right? How do we build a movement that's actually going to address the issues that are relevant to these women, right? And these are issues that range from police violence, right, to issues of being pushed into certain industries, to issues of access to property, to issues of domestic violence, and the ways that all these kinds of things come together. So I think when we're talking about a feminism for the 99%, what we're hoping to do is kind of bridge this gap. You know, I think a lot of times we feel like we have to focus on class, or we have to focus on gender, right? Specifically, or race or whatever. And it's important to be bridging these gaps and to be recognizing the way that gender oppression and class exploitation and oppression, these things are co-constitutive of each other. They've always historically existed together. And if we're going to be fighting them, while we, of course, want to talk about all their differences and recognize their differences and the way they play out in our lives differently, we have to ultimately fight them together on a united front, despite whatever theoretical differences we might have.
And there are some grounds where feminists of liberal and more left or radical traditions can agree, but also areas of debate. It seems that one difference is around the Me Too movement, how much we focus on having powerful men brought down, which we would all agree is a good thing, or having someone fired for sexual harassment versus this kind of broad-based mobilization and call for structural change that both of you are calling about.
Just last night on the Oscars, I just wanted to lift that up, that they were shining a light on sexual harassment and misconduct and abuse. And I lift that up. I don't want to counterpose the International Women's Strike with the work that other women are doing that have different levels of consciousness, that have a different political orientation. I myself am simply less focused on what we may call glass ceiling, where we want to make it so that some women are able to achieve high heights. I come from a poor background. I'm a Black Puerto Rican trans woman raised in poverty, and I grew up looking at people who did not have the means to make a decent living for themselves, that could not make a life, that were barely surviving. So this is what I'm born and bred in, and I'm much more interested in raising the floor. So I don't want to counterpose those things and say one has to be privileged over the other. I'm making it very clear. This is what I'm doing. I really could care less about the ceiling at this point, if we're going with this metaphor, which is what we might call executive feminism.
And the floor has dropped pretty low.
It has dropped extremely low. People are falling and dying all the time, and it's not okay. It's painful and embarrassing. When we go out and protest, Don't Shoot Portland, I know you're going to bring up Don't Shoot Portland and the movement for Black Lives, of which I'm a part, but I know a lot of people think that when we hit the streets and when we get out there and we scream, we're having fun or we're taking some kind of joy in what we're doing. No, it's humiliating that we're fighting for basic human rights and dignity. I don't want to do it. It pains me. But this is what I'm called to do. And I hope that other people feel called to do it too. Come out for International Women's Day.
I think sometimes, and for good reasons and maybe limiting ones, women's marches and feminism have been described as an example of peaceful protests. Though a women's march in 2017 was widely praised because there was hardly an incident. That's something to be proud of, but women also need to be able to make a ruckus. And I think around police politics, often these can be quite confrontational.
Yes.
Alyssa, would you say something about feminism and police politics?
Yes.
And as an activist in the movement for Black Lives and Don't Shoot Portland, what do you bring to the Women's March?
Thank you. So I know that, just like we mentioned, not all feminism is working class feminism. Not all feminism is what we would call intersectional feminism either. So certainly there are women who would call themselves feminists who think that the police are just fine and dandy and that don't pay much attention to or care very much about racial dynamics and racial oppression. And to those feminists, I say good luck to you. Good luck with that struggle. That's not where I'm orienting towards. The movement for Black Lives, particularly Don't Shoot Portland, is what moved me into struggle and helped me to see my own capacity to change the world around me. Just to motion back to my childhood, I grew up watching people that I loved, women that I loved, be brutalized by the police and have to go to jail, didn't have money to post bail, experienced sexual violence at the hands of the police. And this was something that we knew was a regular part of life when you're Black and brown and poor. This is what you experience. So when the movement for Black Lives, the Black Lives Matter movement, began to really move and catch fire, it was incredible because I looked and I thought, wow, we can really stop the police from beating, killing, humiliating, raping, abusing people, and they won't be able to get away with it for much longer. And we're still on that road. There have been quite a few setbacks. We know that. You don't have to look much further than the police contract that was signed by our mayor.
Can you say a bit about that? Topic for another show, but yeah. I mean, what can you just briefly say what was problematic about that?
Ted Wheeler promised or motioned toward a police reform of reeling them in, and as far as we can see, he's only unleashed them more and certainly hasn't done anything in the way of cutting back how much funding they're getting. While people are homeless freezing and dying on the street and in parks. I'm talking about Village of Hope, right? Self-managed homeless camps that, frankly, Ted Wheeler should be praising God that they're doing that and taking care of themselves, because that's something that he doesn't have to do. They won't be flooding the streets and hurting the city's beautiful liberal veneer, where people who are coming through don't have to see people on the street living in destitute. Well, there are people who have self-managed camps all over, and the Village of Hope in particular is out of people's eyesight. I would think that he would be very happy to have them there, but instead, him and Amanda Fritz sent rangers to go and destroy their camp, everything that they built. They had showers, toilets, cleaning facilities, people to make sure that the place is secure.
And there's something to be learned from self-organizing, yes, among the houseless population, and we can learn many things, yeah, from people who find ways of surviving under impossibly difficult.
It's incredible. They couldn't, yeah, even get a meeting with Amanda Fritz until we did a sit-in in her office. They'd been trying for months, and she wouldn't speak to them. These are people who are, it's snowing, it's freezing outside, and people die from it. And no, I won't see you. It's horrendous. So, yeah, that's,
and this is also a feminist issue. Just in closing, Nikki, say a little bit about how to learn more about Thursday, be part of it, and what's going to happen.
Absolutely. So you can go to Women's Strike US, the website. That is where you can find information about the movement at large. You can also look up our event, International Women's Strike, on Facebook, RSVP, you know, come out on Thursday. We're going to start.
There's a page for Portland specifically?
Yes. Yes,
Don't Shoot Portland.
Yeah. It's organized by Don't Shoot Portland. Yes. Yeah, just show up. If you can be there for the rally and the strike time, do it. I would also like to ask men to step up, take over the household labor, and take over the labor at the job place, whatever you can do to support your women in striking. You
know, that's a way men can show solidarity.
Absolutely. Women, you know, come out. Let's all fight together. Let's stand together. And yeah, let's march together and speak out and fight together for a world free of gendered violence, free of capitalist exploitation.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much for being here today, Alyssa Pariah and Nikki Milano. And we'll join you on Thursday at the Women's March and Strike.
4 o'clock, Pioneer Courthouse.
Yeah,
Square.
Keep up the good work, okay?
Thank you.
When you see me on the highway and you nearly shipped your load, you take another look, good buddy, and you almost leave the road. Ain't you never seen a truck-driving woman? 90 pounds of fire in a 5-foot frame. And you better move on over, 'cause I'm right behind you in the left-hand lane.
This is KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Bobby McGee singing Ballad of a Working Mother from an album cleverly entitled Bread and Raises, Songs for Working Women. You often hear on KBOO the phrase listener-supported. Perhaps you hear it so often that it has become white noise that just flitters past without registering. But it's true. Without listener support, there would be no KBOO. The right level of support is different for every KBOO listener. Everyone's contribution makes a huge difference, and we're asking you to join the many listeners who have become members right now. It's easy. Just go to the KBOO webpage, kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Now, Old Moles Joe Clement and Bill Resnick are here with a report on the statewide teacher strike in West Virginia and its ramifications.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here from the Mole, talking to Mole Joe Clement. Joe and I have been watching fairly carefully the teacher strike in West Virginia, now near 2 weeks old. Joe, tell us about the strike, then we can talk about its importance and the future of unionism, ultimately, in this country.
Well, on February 22nd, the whole state of West Virginia, all its public schools, that is, went on strike. They are striking around a set of issues. Part of it is pay, but a large part of it is the health insurance system that they have for the public employees, for all the state employees. And early to mid last week, there was announcements that the governor was going to concede a 5% raise, but the teachers ultimately said that this is not enough. And their rejection of this was complex. Part of it had to do with it just not being enough, but they also didn't trust the state to fulfill its promise. And this was borne out over the weekend by the end of last week when the state legislature didn't approve a raise. But then there's also the fact that the governor's concession didn't at all really address the health insurance costs of the public employee insurance agency that they have in West Virginia. There was a promise of freezes to premiums, but what teachers, rank and file teachers across the state, are demanding is a more substantial fix to the way that it is funded so that these costs don't balloon in the future. And interestingly, the way that they have suggested it should be funded is with a gas tax, a natural gas tax, on the highly lucrative industry that has been supplanting the coal industry in that state.
Yeah, I've read a little bit about the status of public education in West Virginia and in a lot of other places around the country. It's being squeezed and squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. Programs are being abolished. After-school things are being abolished. Music, drama, everything is being abolished. Kids are being forced to pay for sports activities, for their uniforms and stuff. That's also, for them, the teachers see this as destructive of the schools and of the student motivation and capacity. They also say that the schools, because they're so low-paid, teachers who have a little bit of experience flee West Virginia for other places. Many of the teachers with their families are on food stamps, in fact, particularly the new hires. And also they're hiring completely in many districts in West Virginia, completely unqualified people who have had no teaching experience, nor have they gone to any kind of teaching program to come into the schools, which then profoundly undermines the capacity to set up a really strong learning culture when many of the teachers just can't win the respect of their students. Joe, this was a grassroots struggle. It was not led from the top. The union actually was getting feisty because the teachers were getting angrier and angrier. But it was, in fact, the teachers themselves that began and then maintained the strike after the union agreed, although my understanding is the union had to agree or else they would have been sued. It's a complicated story, but tell us about them.
Yeah, there are a lot of reports out there that have described the turn in events as a wildcat strike, and that is not entirely accurate because we don't have a collective bargaining situation or anything like that. And the union hasn't really tried to put the kibosh on the rank and files initiative to continue the strike, although at first it seemed they were willing to accept the governor's concessions. What is so outstanding about this strike is that it has been mobilized and coordinated by a network of rank-and-file teachers that in no small part were organizing through Facebook group West Virginia Teachers United, which, you know, grew to be several thousand, almost as many teachers as there are in the state, which is about 20,000. The teachers have been making sure to maintain community ties so that their struggle is not perceived as a special interest sort of struggle. There were a number of positive news reports, even from just the local news stations across the state, about how teachers were organizing food collection drives to make sure that their most vulnerable and needy students who depend on the free and reduced lunches they may get at school were not missing out on one of the only substantial meals in the day they'd get if they weren't coming to school.
This is Bill Resnick here for Old Mole. Joe Clement and I, both members of the collective, we're doing a roundtable. We're talking about the West Virginia strike. We've already discussed how teachers were fed up and that it was a grassroots strike, but it also has tremendous local support because the teachers there, like in many other places, the parents know that the teachers actually care about their kids and are fighting not just for their jobs and security, they're fighting for the schools our children deserve, which is the great rallying cry of the Chicago teachers, the Philadelphia teachers, the Portland teachers, and the parents come to realize it. Joe, let's talk about the importance of the strike now and the increasingly, it's hard to imagine it could increase, but it is increasing, an increasingly anti-labor attack by conservatives in the state there. And the Democratic Party that used to make an effort to defend the public workers is now so weak in many places that they don't even try. And we're getting a whole set of laws and judicial decisions that could enormously weaken the unions. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you're referring to Janus, which is a Supreme Court case that came to oral argument stage last week. And basically, if it were to pass, then all the people who are in union contracts but not union members themselves wouldn't be required to pay so-called fair share dues to pay for the administration of contracts. And what this would amount to is a large cut in unions' budgets. But what this strike, I think, is showing us is that union power, worker power, is not simply a matter of dues and a matter of money and what money power can do for us. Money is obviously a tool for workers, but it is not really what the union movement ever was about. The union movement was about our labor and our power to control our labor and what this means practically for the people we're trying to influence. So what this strike, I think, is showing is that beyond the claims of illegality or of rightful conduct, workers can act and they can shut things down. And that what will hopefully come out of this is a set of decisions that reflect what the workers were aiming for, and that their choice to walk out of work and to get everyone across the state to walk out of work with them is what achieves that. And it's not a matter of what money can buy or what money can translate into results.
Yeah, there are a number of unions that have survived fairly well right-to-work legislation because they have gained, they recognized, and even if they were business unionism before that, you know, we'll get you the money and you stay out of union politics and let us run things, that business unionism, which now is collapsing. But the social unionism and the grassroots unionism, in places where workers really come together to fight, to struggle, the unions are still able to force management to act a whole lot less brutally.
Yeah, it says a lot about this strike that they were able to force the governor's concession, but then that they were also able to get the state, the legislature, that is, to agree to a raise of they thought that they were approving a 4% raise, though they screwed up and were actually approving a 5% raise, which they had to go back and redact. But this proves that the state was lying to workers when it said that it can't afford really anything more than a 1% or 2% increase. They found the money in this last week for their admittedly insufficient offer, but that was more than they were ever saying was possible before.
Yeah, but unfortunately, part of it, Joe, is that when the teachers who have a lot of power and have great strength and who generally have the support of parents in almost all districts because they, in fact, admire the teachers and like the teachers, and the teachers are now reaching out to parents, it's very successful. But in fact, within the entire set of state services, it's not as if the state is, in fact, raising taxes on the rich or raising the resources that they could easily get from the corporate sector if they stuck together and weren't fighting one another for giving tax subsidies. But it seems to me sometimes what it means is the teachers get more and the daycare workers get less, or the child care workers or the child welfare people or the environmental protectors. Not the police or the firemen, though. They have a powerful union. So it seems to me right now social unionism is great, and social unionism really has to begin building an entire coalition from below. And that would be the only way that, in fact, the resources will go for the things that we need rather than for now a renewed arms race, for example, as an enormous waste.
One of the planks of the union's demands is taxing the natural gas industry, which has been making big inroads in West Virginia and other parts of the United States as a new way to extract value out of fossil fuels. Obviously, West Virginia was coal country and was coal country before, and that also explains a lot of why the union militancy has erupted so widespread and consistently across the state. But one of the demands of the teachers was a tax on natural gas of 1 or 2%, something that is small to their operating budgets, but would be huge to the money it would raise for the state, and that this could be used to plug up the holes.
This is Bill Resnick and Joe Clement of the old, both of us in the Old Mold Collective. We're talking about the West Virginia strike that we've been looking at, examining for the last almost 2 weeks now. It's really important because we've discussed why it's so important, particularly in setting an example for a renewed unionism, a grassroots unionism that'll be necessary to maintain any kind of labor movement in the face of the right-to-work laws and the Janus Supreme Court decision that basically undermines a variety of most union power, except for the grassroots militancy of their members. That they can't stop. Joe, why don't you sum up and tell us, there's a number of other important things about this strike. Let's conclude.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that this strike is in large part being led by women who are a disproportionate amount of our education force in West Virginia, but is also the fact that we call this a teacher strike, but it's not just limited to teachers, either in the scope of who's participating or who it's for. We have school bus drivers who have played an absolutely critical role in gumming up the process of getting kids to school, which has led to school districts just closing outright before they see, you know, that so many teachers haven't come to school. But then you have the fact that teachers are trying to affect change in a system that supports so many other workers besides teachers. The health insurance agency is not just the teachers' health insurance agency, it's all state employees. And when they are fighting for a raise for themselves, they're also fighting for a raise for all state employees. And I think that these are two very enheartening aspects to this strike that should be repeated again and again to remind people of how this is not some superhuman kind of act, and it's not a very self-serving sort of act. It is the community rising up for its own interests.
And right now it seems to me more and more likely people are beginning to realize the great inequalities of not just of income, but how precarious their lives are and how precarious jobs are and how much power the employers have gained. It's not inconceivable that we're going to see large movements growing across the country in the next several years.
Or even right now, Oklahoma teachers are talking about going on a statewide strike, obviously inspired by the actions in West Virginia. Teachers in Pittsburgh were able to get a contract signed with their bosses because they saw what was happening in West Virginia and saw that Pittsburgh was being inspired by that and ready to act just as militantly. This has the potential to inspire action in places we may not have been expecting it to happen.
Joe, good talking to you today.
Thanks, Bill.
Teaching school, you'll never become rich. District don't have the money, that's their pitch. So how can they give themselves high raises when they can't provide us with their wages?
This is KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. As you probably already know, in a Kickstarter campaign, you either make your state a goal, ours is $20,000, or you get nothing. No credit cards are charged until the goal is reached, and if not reached, no cards will be charged at all. Bob Dylan's has generally offered to press home this salient fact.
All or nothing at all. Half a love, never. to me. If your heart never could yield to me, then I'd rather have nothing at all. Oh, or nothing at all. If it's love, there is no in between.
Thanks, Bob. Yes, it's all or nothing at all. There is no in between. Everyone involved with KBOO gives what they can, be it time or money. We need to join us in this important work and act positive change right now just by going to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. And you are listening to KBOO, obviously, on the Oldmore Variety Hour. Now winding up today's program, Jan Hocken is back talking with psychiatrist Elizabeth Berger about the role of international networks in supporting Palestinians living under Israeli occupation and some of the links between human rights and mental health. Berger is a child psychiatrist living in New York City and on the steering committee for the USA Palestine Mental Health Network. Jan?
Elizabeth Berger, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Good to be here.
In a recent article, you and your co-author talk about the psychological impact of living under occupation for the Palestinian people, and I'd like to start with a quote from that article. Under occupation, the people of Palestine face a purposefully inflicted degradation of the entire system of meaning which has given them identity as a people. Not only individual selves, but the collective self has been damaged, unquote. Well, let's start with having you describe some of the psychological dynamics and effects of living under occupation that I know you've written about and also been very close to through your work in Palestine. And then we can turn to how you and your Palestinian colleagues are addressing the suffering on both the individual and collective levels you cite as so important. So let's start with some of those dynamics you've described.
Sure. As a context, in the occupied territories, daily life frequently involves being stopped at checkpoints or in the street by occupying soldiers for no reason at all. These are frequently occasions for being verbally insulted, slapped, interrogated endlessly, undressed in public, or menaced with weapons. Harassment by soldiers or settlers happens every day. The experiences of home incursion, often in the middle of the night, and detention are also commonplace and particularly harrowing. These traumatic humiliations pose a challenge for mental health practice. How can a man who's been slapped and abused in front of his wife and children resume his role as a protective husband and father? How can a woman who's been physically tied up and subjected to sexual taunts in interrogation, resume her life as a full human being? There are limitations to our standard mental health approaches to meet the needs of people who've endured this kind of mistreatment. The first limitation is the enormous scope of the problem of humiliation in Palestine. Violence has formed the core of the Palestinian reality since 1948 and continues today in conditions of grave material hardship. The Palestinian community, over 5 million people, is subject to wars, bombings, shootings, house demolitions, destruction of farmland, checkpoints and closures, fragmentations of neighborhoods, extrajudicial assassinations, states of siege, and particularly mass detention. It's estimated that over one-third of all Palestinian men since 1967 have been detained in Israeli prisons, often without any charges being brought against them, and sometimes for decades. Men, women, and children are often mistreated in detention, to a degree constituting torture. Over a period of 6 months in 2014, for example, there were over 600 children arrested just in Jerusalem, of which nearly 40% reported sexual abuse. The consequences of detention alone constitute an enormous public health problem. These insults and injuries are accompanied by a global propaganda campaign. which projects a debased image of Palestinian identity as dangerous, irrational, and dishonest. Through this, the intangible and cultural heritage of the Palestinian people has suffered a further degradation. A second limitation to conventional mental health treatment is that the core of humiliation is shame, and the experience of shame is particularly difficult to address with standard therapies. CBT, for example, is more effective with aspects of trauma-related symptoms, such as fearful re-experiencing, rapid heart rate, than with the experience of shame. Then, too, shame interferes with the capacity to remember and to articulate a personal narrative. Humiliated persons want to hide. Withdrawal from intimacy within family and social relationships thus further damages the potential for therapy and for recovery. Reactions to humiliation can also stimulate disorganized feelings of rage, which undermine treatment and can be misdirected. Humiliation stimulates community polarization and may contribute to impulsive and destructive actions aimed at achieving revenge. What can we say then about the need for the integration of innovative approaches to repair the impact of humiliation in Palestine? There's certainly room for conventional interventions such as medications as well as psychotherapy. But we recommend that we widen our therapeutic scope in interpersonal and collective directions. For example, since humiliation attacks identity, especially the expression of identity through social worlds, an exploration of sources of connection, such as couples counseling or family-oriented treatment, may be especially helpful, as well as efforts toward re-involvement broadly in cultural and community groups and in political action. We also have to recognize that not everyone is a patient. One adolescent who had suffered in detention was brought to a psychiatrist by his family, but refused to cooperate with the interview, saying, "I'm not crazy." For many ex-detainees, a discussion group made up of peers with a leader who himself has experienced the humiliation of detention may be more appropriate. Groups such as the Prisoners Club in Palestine offer self-help based on this model. But beyond the problem of humiliation with individuals includes an entire people whose integrity and value have been under assault as a culture. So there's a therapeutic meaning in a solidarity movement which holds the State of Israel accountable for these wrongs on an ethical level. And of course, in the big picture, there can be no genuine and full validation of the Palestinian narrative without the actual restoration of justice. Working toward an end of politicized humiliation can open the door to reconciliation on an international as well as a personal level, in which it is possible for injury to be counted, acknowledged, and worked through.
Well, let's talk some about that process of acknowledging and working through in this vision of a kind of community psychiatry that also goes beyond bearing witness or documenting or acknowledging trauma, but also carries a kind of moral responsibility for addressing it, its sources. And I know one of the programs you've been very active in working with as a child psychiatrist along with colleagues is a program through the schools, a comprehensive in-school student support mental health program. Can you tell us about that program, what you're doing and what you hope to achieve?
Sure. Working with these themes, we've developed a wonderful mental health program for children in Palestine through an international organization, the Palestinian Medical Education Initiative, or PMED, under our executive director, Dr. Michael Morse. The school program is now in its third year of operation with several schools thus far in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. The Comprehensive Student Support Program model involves one trainer working intensively with one school for a period of 1 year. Its two goals are to enhance coping among all students and to implement individualized plans for specific students who present learning, behavioral, or psychological problems. All aspects of the program are delivered in Palestine by Shireen Abdeen, our excellent PMED mental health clinician and trainer. To create genuine community supporting student mental health, the clinician trainer brought together the entire school staff, including the principal, guidance counselors, and all teachers, for 12 hours of intensive workshops on mental health. The training stressed the importance of communication with students and alertness to signs of individual distress, such as poor grades or disruptiveness, as well as school-wide issues such as bullying. An important aim of the school staff training was changing the school culture from a punishment model to an encouragement model for student discipline. During the year, all of the parents, too, were invited to a similar 12-hour training program addressing some of the common problems that children might present at school and the role of psychological factors in these problems. Both the school staff trainings and the parent trainings were evaluated by participants as very valuable. Some parents and teachers described them as life-changing. A key element in the program was creating within the school a weekly committee composed of the school principal, the guidance counselor, and two teachers. Each meeting, led by the trainer, lasted 2 to 3 hours. The committee established a communication pyramid that assigned each member to a small group of teachers to capture input from all enrolled students, teachers, and committee members with responsive communication both directions. The committee then developed a daily 15-minute activity for the entire school, each week with a new theme. For example, how the students felt about their relationships at home with teachers or with peers. Each student would write a response, which would be collected. Through this activity, the staff gained insight into meaningful issues within the lives of students, and this new knowledge formed the basis of activities. For example, when students were asked, "How do I feel when someone calls me names or hits me?" Their written responses inspired classroom discussions and special workshops for students, parents, and teachers on bullying and healthier ways to promote conflict resolution. One pressing issue with profound impact on student well-being was the escalating military and settler violence from the occupying forces that erupted in October 2015 in Jerusalem. Many students seemed agitated by these violent events, while others were withdrawn and demoralized. The weekly committee in Jerusalem schools then instituted several crisis intervention programs, such as an art project, an exercise relaxation project, and a balloon activity for younger children, in which students attached balloons to their legs and ran around the room bursting the balloons. The school reached out to all of its families through social media, encouraging parents to prepare special foods and engage their children in special activities during these difficult days. In addition to these activities aimed to enhance coping overall within the student body, each committee addressed individual students who presented special problems. Many of these students had already earned a negative reputation within the school, but others who'd previously escaped notice were now being referred to the committee. The 15-minute activity had proven to be a sensitive instrument to alert teachers to troubled youngsters. A quiet child might pass in a paper saying, "I hate my father," during a writing exercise, or draw a morbid picture related to military violence. In this way, the school was able to identify students at risk. Each student referred to the committee was entered into a list and given a score. 10 indicated big problems, and a 0 indicated that the problems were now resolved. The committee would then gather information from meeting with teachers and inviting parents for a conference, and in this way develop a plan. Sometimes a plan would be quite simple, for the classmates to list all the likable things about a particular student, for example. For other students, the committee plan might involve referring the student to the guidance counselor or developing a behavioral contract. About a third of the students on the committee's list were referred to outside agencies in the community for professional evaluation. A child who seemed to have difficulty hearing, to require an evaluation for learning disability, or to consult with a psychiatrist for possible diagnosis such as ADHD or autism spectrum disorder. A small number of youngsters received medications from psychiatrists in the community, which in most cases led to dramatic improvement. Although initially, stigma caused families to be resistant to these outside referrals to professional clinicians, over time, more than three-quarters of the family did follow through. At the end of the year, we found that students on the committee's list experienced significant improvement. Over 80% of these students were rated as improved. It's our conclusion, then, that the trauma of the occupation damages mental health through many pathways, both direct and indirect. The common denominator is disrupted relationships expressed in multiple areas, such as family distress, peer conflict, and poor relationships between students and teachers. Bullying among students and punitive behaviors by parents and teachers are key examples of trauma-related relationship patterns that impact student and family well-being. Palestine's a people culture. Harnessing this cultural value in mental health programming can enhance well-being in sustainable ways. I'd like to close by saying that childhood can only be as secure as a family and community that supports that childhood. So student mental health in Palestine depends ultimately on a global effort to guarantee justice and freedom to people of Palestine, so that they and their children can have the opportunity to fulfill their full potential as human beings.
Well, Elizabeth Berger, this is such an important work you and your colleagues are carrying out, and listeners can learn more about your work through the Palestinian Medical Education Initiative. The website will be posted on our website, along with your piece today, and more about the USA Palestine Mental Health Network that you're a part of. And people can also learn about a petition, a protest of an international conference that's scheduled next year in Tel Aviv, and you've been part of protesting that as part of that network. And I'd also like to point out that much of the work there, which focuses on teachers as activists and having insights about what it means to be part of an ethical community, shares a great deal in common with what teachers are doing in West Virginia now. And so, viva all teachers in the world who have so much, carry a lot of responsibility, but also have so much to teach.
Absolutely. Well, certainly we appreciate if you can post these links on the KABU website, and absolutely, I think what we see in Palestine has great applicability globally for people struggling everywhere.
Yeah, and there's much about equity. joy and play and pleasure, as well as trauma and suffering. That is part of what you described today. Thank you so much for being with us. This is Jan Hocken talking with Elizabeth Berger about the work of mental health and education in Palestine. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. A pleasure.
And that concludes our program for today. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KABU website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics on past programs. Thank you to all you listeners who have already donated to our Build a City of Media Makers Kickstarter campaign. If you haven't done so yet, please, we need you. Remember, it's all or nothing at all, and it's so easy. Just go to our webpage, kbuo.fm/kickstarter.